faithful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
He did that all week and you still laugh. Okay.
She's a good student.
Very good. So here we go. I'll shuffle them all up, see which is the first question to come out. Very good. First question. What is the ordination process at Bodhinyana Dhammasara? Is it 2 years as a Anagarika, and there is a long waiting list? Also, what happens to a monk's and nun's superannuation fund? Do they get automatically converted into good merit and karma once ordained? Yes. Usually, I think it's the same with Dhammasari. You can ask the nuns, but at Bodhinyana Monastery, we pay a lot of attention to QC, quality control. So when a person comes as a prospective monk, we say, you, nah, get out of here. Just to test them out. And if they survive that test, they can be there for 1 year as an Anagarika wearing white. And after 1 year as an Anagarika wearing white, once the white clothes are dirty enough, they're almost brown anyway, then we could ordain them as a novice monk. And as you all know, a novice monk, novice means no vice. And then after 1 year as a novice, we can ordain them as a monk. So that's minimum. Sometimes they take longer than 1 month, 1 year as an anagarika, another year as a novice, sometimes longer than that. But that's the minimum requirement of Bodhinyana Monastery. Dhammasara, you accept anyone, don't you? Any riffraff goes in there. No, they've got very, very high standards as well. So is it 2 years as an anagarika or 1 year? Two years as a novice. It's tough being a bhikkhuni. And what happens to your superannuation fund? I haven't got a clue because I never had one. Oh, I came from that generation where you didn't get any super. But actually, next year I should be able to get a pension. Yes! But no, we don't get any pensions. We leave that to somebody else. Or you give it to your family or something. So you don't need anything because you're supposed to abandon all of your worldly goods and just become a monk or a nun. But even though next year I'll become a pensioner, this year, when I'm 65, already I get Meals on Wheels. Just like you've got Meals on Wheels for the last week. They come in people's cars, so we still get Meals on Wheels. That's the only thing which I get. Anyway, so the waiting list is usually very long. It's just sometimes it's sort of, why can't people teach proper Buddhism in other monasteries and not be such control freaks? And just encourage monks and nuns to actually to be able to live their life. You don't need to tell them what to do. You know, there are some retreats you go on. They tell you when to get up, when to sit, ring a bell, when to walk, ring a bell, when to go to the toilet, ring a bell. Can you ring a bell to tell you when to go to the toilet? It's not natural. Just the same sitting and walking. It's not natural. So sometimes that people think that to have discipline, you have to control people. But discipline always comes from within, not from without. And this is one of the reasons why you inspire people, encourage people. And this is the way these retreats are run here. If you're tired, you can take a rest. If you're really hot, carry on meditating. And that's how monasteries should run. Trust people that they're already motivated enough. And as the Buddha said, the Buddha, the big teacher, he would not discipline monks or nuns. He would just say, here are the empty places. Here are the kutis. Go off and meditate. He did not have CCTV cameras in every hut, making sure the monks get up at the right time in the morning. No, just trust people. Because it's so hard to be a bhikkhuni or even a monk that by the time you actually make it into these robes, you're already more than well motivated. You're not in here for an easy life. You're here because you really want to try and develop that holy life, the spiritual life, to its maximum. So that's why a monastery like this, or Bodhinyana, or even Dhammasara, they're so well run, it's a huge waiting list. Because there aren't many monasteries like Bodhinyana or Dhammasara, none like Dhammasara. We're trying to get there, it takes time. But at the moment, these are, especially you people who live in Western Australia, you don't know what state-of-the-art monasteries you've got here. These are really well known throughout, not just Australia, throughout the world. So you should be very proud of your monasteries, but the downside of that is so hard to get in. But if you really want to, if you're really determined, of course you can get in. From the suttas, there were a lot of arahat at the time of the Buddha, and many became arahat in a very short time. Was it exaggerated? If not, and why not nowadays? Exactly, why not? Number one, a short time meant 17, 20, 30 years. That was a short time in the time of the Buddha. And already, sort of twice today, I've mentioned Anuruddha. Anuruddha was one of the chief disciples of the Buddha. And he had some, it's an interesting story about Anuruddha. He had it's a good story because it tells you a little bit about Anatta as well. He had this great good karma from a previous life. He was so generous, always giving to other people, that the karmic result in this life, he would never ever hear the words, there isn't any. If he wanted something, it would be there for him. So whatever he desired or wanted, he'd always get it because of the incredible good karma in a previous life. So as a young kid, he was playing a game of marbles with his friends and betting, gambling. He was betting his lunch, which was these cakes his mother had made him. And he kept betting and he kept losing. And when he lost all his lunch, he had a maid, in a very well-to-do family, sent the servant back, go and get some more cakes. So the servant came back with some more cakes and he lost them a second time. So he sent them a third time, and everything is done three times in Buddhism. It has to be three times he went back for cakes. And after the third bunch of cakes got lost, he sent the servant back, and this time the mother said, there aren't any cakes, they all run out, no more left. And so the servant walked back from the house to where his little Aniruddha was playing marbles and losing all the time, with a basket covered with a cloth, with nothing in it. But because of the law of karma, the heavenly beings, they realized this is like a law of nature they cannot allow to be broken. So the heavenly beings intervened, and they put these heavenly cakes in the basket, without the servant knowing about it. And so when Aniruddha saw the servant come and said, have you got any cakes in there? And he said, natty cakes. And natty means there isn't any. Natty cakes. And so he gave the empty basket, what he thought was an empty basket, to Aniruddha, and he saw these heavenly cakes in there. And he ate one of them and said, my goodness, all these years my mother has just given me ordinary cakes. These natty cakes, they're the best. And what it meant, natty cakes, which means there isn't any, became a special type of cake, which is just like anatta, non-self, becomes the very important, essential self. Anatta is not nothing. Anatta is the essential consciousness. We always love making something out of nothing. Really, it's nothing. But nothing, yes, nothing is a great thing. They make something out of it. So that's one of the, or it was also Lewis Carroll, Alice Through the Looking Glass, I think it was. When Alice, she arrived at the square or where the Red Queen was. And the Red Queen sort of asked Alice, she said, I'm waiting for a messenger. Did you see anyone on the road when you came here? And Alice replied, I saw no one on the road. You saw no one. My goodness, you must have excellent eyesight. It's enough for me to see someone, but you can see no one. And did anyone come before you? The Red Queen asked one of the guards. He said, no one came before Alice. Exactly, because Alice saw no one on the road. So it was always making something out of a no one. And we do that in language and also in religion as well. We make something out of nothing. Natty cakes becomes a special type of cake, when really it means there isn't any cakes. Anyway, that was Aniruddha. But in his story, once he became a monk, it took him 17 years to become a stream winner. 17 years with the Buddha, full-time monk, meditating. But later on, he got all the psychic powers and became one of the most famous monks. But 17 years... And they say that's no long time. So when they say, you read in the sutras, not a long time, it means 20 years, 30 years. In the great scheme of things, eon after eon you've been reborn. This is a shiny time, short time. So for goodness sake, don't think 9 days you're going to get something. But you do get something, but keep on going. 17 years, then you might get something. Okay, so that's actually what it really means. Can anyone come and stay for a few days at Bodhinyana? How can one get into the 3-month range retreat? You can stay at Bodhinyana, but of course it's really popular, so you have to talk to the guest monk. I think we're now doing that on the internet. We started that on the internet yet, guest monk? Not yet, but it's going to come soon, just book on the internet, because the poor guest monk has so many phone calls, and it's not nice when you say, sorry, we're full, no, you can't stay. And say, when is the next availability, 2020? So it's really nasty. So we're going to start doing it on the internet, so you can book in for the guest month on the internet. But the 3-month range retreat, now that's tough to get into. We only allow 12 people to stay here during the range retreat for 3 months. There's basically one of the reasons I limited to 12, because they all want interviews, and it's really hard work for me. I've got to sort of limit it. If there's 60 people here, I'd have no range retreat for myself. We'd be talking to you all day for 3 months. So we keep it just, and I won't have any time for the monks and the nuns or anybody. So I keep it to 12 people here for the range retreat. And you book in on the first day of the range retreat, the full moon day, on what's called Asalha day. And in July. I forget what day that is. When it's July the 19th or something? Sometimes around that this year. And on that day, midnight, we open up bookings. So you can do it online, you can ring up, and that's the day we take the first 12. And that's, you have to stay here for the whole 3 months. So we don't do the part-time, it has to be the whole 3 months or nothing. So that's for the range retreat. We have to have done some meditation before, and have to be in good health, because, you know, this, the nearest doctor is a long way away, and you can't get a lift, you know, from one of the lay people staying in the monastery. You have to look after yourself, be in good health, and be willing to do the whole 3 months. Dear Ajahn, I experienced extremely pleasant and peaceful mental states during this retreat, and I was looking for the next word, but. They were not like what you described. No bright lights at all, simply free and peaceful. Great, that's good enough. Didn't I tell you yesterday, or was it this morning? Don't allow what you've learned to stand in the way of truth. So if that's peaceful, if that's beautiful, go for it. Bright lights will come later on. And how do you know if it's jhana? You know if it's jhana if I can give you electric shock defibrillations and know what no one thinks. That's a good sign it's jhana. And you can't hear anything and you can't feel your body and you're blissed out of your head. And also, another thing about the jhanas or about good meditation is the afterglow. When you come out afterwards, you're just so happy, so peaceful. So that's why sometimes, I'm telling you all my tricks, sometimes you come out of jhana and say, Ajahn Brahma had this wonderful experience, this jhana. Look at it, ah, no, that wasn't jhana, that's nowhere near it. You know, you're hopeless. And I look, see what your reaction is. If you say, what are you talking about, Ajahn Brahma? You know, you don't know anything, Ajahn Brahma. I said, yeah, that was just a test, that wasn't a jhana. But if you say, oh, okay, never mind, then that may have been a jhana. The afterglow means people can abuse you, they can upset you. You just don't get fazed at all. You're so peaceful, so calm, so happy that no one can actually disturb you. And that's the afterglow of jhanas. 5 hindrances, gone for a long time. A non-return is said to have no sensory desires and as such would not be sexually active. Is it not possible for a non-returner to have sex with their partner out of compassion and loving kindness to satisfy their partner? I am sorry, can't be done. When, who was it? Uga, the householder, when he became an anagami, you know, in those days that people had many wives. He had, how many wives? He had 3 wives, I think, at the time. And as soon as he became an anagami, he told his wives, he said, look, you know, I can't have sex with you anymore. I'm an anagami. And he said that, you know, whatever you want to do, I'll help you. If you want to go home to your family, or if you want to go and find another partner in life, I'll support you. But, you know, I'm an anagami now. He's going to go off to the monastery and become a bhikkhu. And one of his wives said, yeah, okay, I'll become a bhikkhuni. One of the other ones said, I'm going back home to my family. And the other one, you know, can you find me a husband? So, you know, it was his job in those days to make sure that the wife who still wanted to have a husband, that he found a suitable one which she liked. You know, gave them the money so they could start a life together. But there's no way they could have sex. So be careful. If you really want sex, you better not become an anagami. If you're getting close, you better leave today. It just can't be done anymore. Even physically. It was interesting to know whether if an anagami took Viagra, whether he could get erection. That'd be an interesting one to test out. But without, certainly, naturally, no way. Dear Ajahn, you are a great speaker. How do you become a one like that? Just practice. There was one of the supporters, disciples in Singapore. Many of you know her, Angie. She came to stay in Bodhinyana Monastery for a week. And she was a bit restless, so she went up to the library to see what was there. And she found, hidden away, an old cassette tape of a talk I gave about 30 years ago. And she wanted to find out, you know, was I always a good speaker? So she got the oldest talk she could and listened to it. She came up to me afterwards and said, "That was the worst talk I've ever heard in my life." I said, "Yeah, just you start wherever you are and you learn as you go along." So you didn't start as a great speaker, you just learn it. So does one, this is one of my favorite questions, does one who becomes fully enlightened, does not ordain within 7 days, simply keel over and die? Yes, they do. So if you become fully enlightened on this retreat, you've got a choice. Join the Sangha, become a monk or a nun, or that's it. And say, why? That's really strange. It is because if you understand something of what I said this morning about the will, that will is an important thing just to keep you alive, literally the will to live. And I'm sure that you've heard stories, if not actually come across people, who maybe the most common case is, you know, you've lost your partner. You know, the partner you've been with for so many years, which you love so dearly, dies. And basically you've lost the will to keep going, to live, and you die. It's similar but more extreme to someone who's an arahant. There's nothing to live for anymore. And because of that, lacking the will to live, unless you become a monk or a nun, then you can actually serve and inspire other people and be a field of merit for them. You understand that's so true. And because of that, you either, to make your life worthwhile, go and become a monk or a nun, or else you're out of here. That's all it is. It's not negativity, it's just nature. So, if you become an anagami, no more sex. If you become an arahat, you have to join, no more hair, otherwise you're dead. And nothing can stop that. If we have a good chance to give a land as a dana for a monk, dwelling place or meditation retreat center, what would be the criteria? Location must be near forest, sea, or anything we need to take note when selecting the land. The most difficult thing is not to give the land, is to find a teacher. I've been offered much land to build a meditation retreat center. What's the point? I've already got one. And you can't do too many retreats. I'm only doing too many retreats every year. But land is very difficult to find, and it's also, I've got a much better idea than land, if you want to get a new retreat center or a new monastery. Get an old cruise liner, a boat, and then you can imagine, that boat, we can do, say, a retreat, you know, starting in Perth, and saying go to Colombo, you know, and so, I don't know, how many days would that be? 10, 15 days retreat? Number one, no one could leave. If you wanted to go home, sorry. If you want to swim, fine. And you have really nice rooms, and it's quiet because, you know, there's no sound of any aircraft, no forest fires or anything. And you're perfectly quiet, nice food, you've got your own cabins there, nice and quiet. And then when you get to Colombo, you know, I can give a few talks in Colombo, BMICH, for a day or two, and then take on a new crew, and we have the next retreat over to Chennai. Is it Chennai or is it Bangalore? Chennai. A retreat to Chennai, to Prasad's place. And then from Chennai, where we land there, give a talk in Chennai. And then we can go, where's the next step after Chennai? We can go towards Europe. We can go towards Norway and give a retreat in Norway on the way. See the fjords at the same time. And then after the retreat to Norway, then we can go over to UK and give a retreat there. And then from there we can... Ohio's not by the sea, is it? You're stuffed. We can go somewhere close to Ohio. And so do So we have this floating monastery. And it'd be great for monks and nuns because we don't have any problem with visas. So one of the most difficult things for monks and nuns is getting the visas in Australia to stay here. So you've just got a floating monastery. I don't need any visas. Anywhere I can come, big enough. So that's my next monastery project. The floating monastery. It's actually, think outside the box. It's got some possibilities. Why does it always have to be in a forest? Why does it always have to be sort of in a mountain? What about the sea? You get some great solitude at sea. And anyone who wants to go on a personal retreat, we just put them in a little boat with a nice rope about 1 kilometre long, and you can just be dragged behind. How many monks have you produced so far? Heard there's a waiting list for people wanting to become a monk under your guidance. What would be the prerequisite to be a monk and practice under your guidance? I've already said that. And it's a fascinating. On these retreats, it's amazing how the same question comes up two or three times in the box of an evening. And how they're so close together in the box. Fascinating synchronicity there. It happens so often. So anyway, how many monks have you produced so far? I'm not going to answer that because I remember Ajahn Chah telling me once, and it was one thing which really hit me hard. Ajahn Chah, thousands of monastic disciples. And he told me just maybe 6 months before he stopped teaching, he said, I've built many monasteries in my life, but I haven't built many monks. Ordained them, yes, but built a monk, built a nun. You've ordained them, they're there, but have they really built a really good, enlightened monk or a nun? And he said, that's the hardest thing to do. Yeah, you can ordain them, you can teach them, you can get them well fed, but to get a really great monk or a great nun so they can go out there and teach from their experience, that's a tough thing to do. Dear Venerable, offering land and money, that's important, but that's not really what's important. Offering the facilities and the time so we can really get some very good monks, nuns, laymen and laywomen. That's the most important thing to build. Not temples. We've got to have the temples. But yeah, you can have these beautiful buildings in Dharamsala. But that is not what people go to Dharamsala for. They go there for the good sangha. Dear Venerable, is everything that happens in our lives predestined? I knew you were going to write this. I saw, because all the courses, that this question had to be asked. How can you show it? How can you prove that it's predestined? Because it happened. Therefore, it was destined to happen. Was it? The point is, even if it was predestined, or if it's not, you don't know the course, you don't know what's going to happen. The point is that you do not know what's coming next. The future is so uncertain. And because of that, even if it was predestined, you couldn't find out what it's going to be. Life is not a book, and you can just turn to the last page to find out who did it. You don't know what's coming around the corner. Look behind you quickly. So, that's why it's a question which doesn't really have any meaning, no practical meaning. How would you kindly recommend books to read on Buddhism, the teachings of the sutras? Read the Book of the Heart. That is much more important. Read what mindfulness shows you. Yeah, you can read books, but there's so many people read books. The information you have is more than enough. So, if you're going to Chennai, how many books do you really need to read about Chennai to really understand what it's like? Maybe just one book, but then go there and find out for yourself. But what people do, they read so many books about Buddhism, they just travel down. They're the Lonely Planet Guide to Nibbana. That's what the suttas are like. And they just read all these different Lonely Planet guides, but they never go there. What's the point? So read a little bit and then go there. Dear Ajahn, so I didn't get the jhanas. What do you mean? There's another couple of days to go yet. Who knows what's going to happen next? So you don't say, I didn't get the jhanas. It's not yet. The nimitta, even the beautiful breath. Despite this, I learned so much. The wonderful art of watching the trees go and shutting up. That is 90% there. I have also gained an incredible sense of joy and confidence that I am on the right path. Excellent. Thank you so much for making this possible. No worries. Anytime. You're welcome. Can you use your considerable powers to send a message of thanks to the ants for presenting me with countless home of entertainment, hours of entertainment? And what have you, well, what type of ants did you mean? There's many types of ants here. It must have been the retreat ants, as I said yesterday. The retreat. Those are the ants who gave you so much entertainment. And what have you done to the mosquitoes? Amazing, there are none at all. The power of loving kindness is much better than ever any other repellent. Because we always chant, may all mosquitoes be happy and well somewhere else. But not here. Is there... Okay, I knew I'd get all these will questions and predestination and stuff after the talk this morning. If there is no free will, then we never really need to worry if we have made the correct choice. Is that right? Exactly. Don't worry at all. Not your fault. Isn't that wonderful? Not my fault. So, if you go to, you're accused of doing something and you go to court, that's a wonderful defense. That's the Buddhist defense. I didn't do anything. I wasn't there. Somebody else. Not me. Just my five candidates. No self in there. I'm not to blame. And so the judge says, okay, I'm not going to blame you. I'm just going to send your five candidates to prison. is that right? And can we always forgive both us? Also, is that joke about the person? He was a pickpocket. And his defense was, it was just his hand did the crime. The rest of his body was actually, you know, quite innocent. That's a good argument. Because only his hand did the pickpocket, the rest of his body was innocent. So the judge actually said, that's a very good argument. So I'm just going to send your hand to jail. The rest of you can do whatever you want. And then the guy, oh, that's in the last part of the joke, the guy took off his false hand and gave it to the judge. Poor old judge. Okay. Then we never really need to worry if we have made a correct choice, is that right? And we can always forgive both ourselves and others. Exactly. Forgiving yourself. If you realize there's no self inside, then you can forgive so easily. And you can forgive others. There's no problem anymore. So the only reason why we keep all that idea of revenge and guilt and anger is because of our sense of self. When there's no sense of self, you understand that people have so many reasons, extenuating circumstances, why they do what they did. And sometimes you've been in that situation. And you're not a bad person, you just made a bad choice. And you look at that bad choice, where did that come from? So often it's just, you know, your upbringing and just how you've been trained to make those choices. It's very hard to criticize anybody. If you understand non-self. That's why I like mentioning this book I read when I was a young man called Erewhon, which is nowhere, spelt backwards. And part of that book was a fantasy novel about a society which had developed independent of everywhere else. And in that society, they swapped things around. It's just the way they evolved. If you did a crime, like stealing, you weren't punished. It was considered to be an illness. You were sick. So, if you did a crime, you went to see the doctor. But if you were sick, like what we think is sick, then you were punished for that. Which is actually a good argument. If you have a cold, it's because you haven't been looking after your health. You haven't been eating properly. You haven't been exercising. It's your fault if you have a cold. And if you do have a cold, that means you're spreading the bugs to other people. You are a menace to society. And so people who had colds, they were put in jail, you know, to teach them a lesson. Look after your health next time. Don't mess around. If you have heart attacks, it's your fault. And you have a heart attack and all these people have to rush around keeping you alive just because you don't eat the right food and you're a drain on society and you cause immense economic sort of difficulty, and you know how difficult the economy is these days, and heart attack victims, they cost a lot of money, and it's their fault. So in this society, anyone got a heart attack, they were sent to jail. 20 years. As a warning to others. It's interesting. What it's doing is making us see things from a different angle. It's not saying one is right, one is wrong. But why is it we punish people who make wrong choices and do what's called crimes? But people who make wrong choices and get sick, we heal them. The real answer is we should be able to heal both. That's compassion. Anyway, when we leave this real world of Jhana Grove and go out to the artificial world, there are things we have to do to keep our jobs. Buying clothes, shoes, dyeing hair, etc. How do you strike a balance? You just shave off your hair. You don't need to dye it. That's the greatest balance. No, it's live simply. Number one, downsize your house. Get a small apartment. Like many people do these days. People like a house with a garden in the back. It means you have to maintain that garden. It's a lot of work looking after a garden. And what happens is that on the weekends, on holidays, you've got no time at all. You've got to look after the garden. If you have a swimming pool like many people do, that's really a lot of work. So live in an apartment. If you want to go to a swimming pool, there's Cottesloe Beach, there's Scarborough Beach. There's so many places. If you want a park, go to King's Park. If that's a nice garden and somebody else looks after it, you can just enjoy it. And how many rooms do you need in your house? Just one to sleep in, and look at your little room now. It's really comfortable, pretty easy to clean. You don't need a big house. If there's maybe six of you in your house, you look at these cottages. I can give you the plan. That could be your next house. So simple, so easy. It hardly costs you much to build one of those. Which means you don't have to work so hard and get a big mortgage and have to pay it off for years and years and years. So if you downsize, it's so simple to live. But what do people have? These huge houses with, they've got spare rooms in case somebody comes to visit. If your friends come to visit from Sri Lanka, put them up in a hotel. It's much cheaper. The amount of money you can save by having a small house, one bedroom or two bedrooms if there's two people who live there, the amount of money you save, you can put them in the Hilton Hotel, the best suites. So, you know, you don't need to have them in your own house. Why do you have guest rooms? That's what hotels are for. Guest rooms, were. And kitchens? Who needs a kitchen? You can go downstairs, go out into the street, and you get much better food that you can cook, and it means you don't have to wash up afterwards. How long does it take to cook? You've got to go and get all the ingredients, you've got to get the recipe, heat everything up, cook it, takes such a long time, you put it on the plate, and the people don't like it, but you know, if it's a restaurant and you don't like the food, you can actually complain. Can you complain to your wife? You get hit if you complain to your wife, the food's not good today. And the amount of food you can get in a restaurant, you can get breakfast, you can get lunch, and it's really high quality. And yes, it costs more money than cooking yourself, but the amount of money you save on kitchens. Kitchens are probably one of the most expensive parts of a house. Honestly. So, don't need a kitchen. Just have a little room like in here. Maybe, you know, have a kettle and a microwave like we have here, just if you want to make yourself a quick snack. Other than that, go outside and get something to eat. And if it's a long way away, you can just ring up these days. You know, dial a pizza. get so much food, Sri Lankan food, Thai food, whatever you want, Chinese food, it delivers to your door. You don't need a kitchen. Imagine just how much more time you will have to meditate then. So, this is the ideal home. When you downsize like that, you don't need a garden, you don't need a swimming pool, you only need little one or two rooms, count out how many people are living there, just a common room, just with a microwave, eat outside. How much would that house cost, or that apartment cost? That would be really cheap. And it also means you can lock it up, because it's a small apartment, no thief would burgle your house. They take one look at it, they're so poor, it's a waste of time going in there. They go to these huge houses, these stupid people buy these big houses because they must leave lots of stuff in there. So that's how you can live simply. You don't need very much. You don't need a car. If you're living in the city, get a bicycle. Good for your health. How many of you got a car? Two cars? Three cars? Four cars? Get a bike. Very easy. Or even better, skateboard. That's really cheap. Anyway, that's how you can strike a balance. At least, no, seriously though, just downsize. Live more simply. Because now the Australian gold is just unsustainable. According to the environment, climate change, we build such big houses and they're not necessary. That is what's causing a lot of global warming. And people say, but if we all have small houses, the economy will go down. Yes, there won't be so many people who are building houses, but there will also not be so many people going to hospitals, stressed out, bankrupt, have got no money to spend. You'd have much more time, free time, because you won't need so much. You don't need to work so hard to pay off all these debts for things you don't need. Anyway, if the being that I take myself to be, a tearing pairing the barn, and then does samsara just end for me with everyone else still wandering tethered to the wheel, or other beings, non-existence outside of my own mind, projectors, many thanks. Now there are the other beings there, but if one person gets enlightened, they usually infect other people. Enlightenment is like SARS or MERS. It's contagious. So when Ajahn Chah got enlightened, he infected so many other people. We caught the Nibbana bug from him. And now I'm spreading it to you. So you're getting infected too. So when one person leaves, a lot of other people leave as well. Wisdom is contagious. So is compassion. It rubs off on people. How can one get wisdom developed when you're in deep jhana, like the man was taken to the hospital? He was more like a dead person at the time, but afterwards, when he looked back on that experience, that is where you have the data for wisdom. How can you enjoy any money when you're working? Because you're working, you can't spend anything. You've got to work, 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 work. But you work to get the money to enjoy your life afterwards. This is getting jhana is like going to work. You can't spend the money while you're at work, but you go to the work to get the money to spend afterwards. So jhana gives you the cash which you can spend on wisdom, on insight. With no jhanas, no cash, no wisdom. No work, no cash, no food. So that's how it works. Not at the right time, not at that time, but afterwards. It causes insight to come afterwards. The metta chant is stuck in my head like a broken record. It's not a broken record. It's a hot-selling top 100 disc. Maybe. I'm very focused and happy while doing the chanting, but I'm worried it will prevent me from going into a deeper layer of meditation. Don't just chant it. Listen to what it says. We've got some really, really good words in there. I already mentioned to you, be content and easily satisfied. Not proud and demanding in nature. Be someone who's very simple, even in meditation. And also in that metta chant, it also, you've probably heard this last time, it also explains why there are so many monk monasteries in the world and hardly any non-monasteries. It explains that. Why nuns have a hard time. And the reason is, if you listen very carefully, in the Metta chant it said, whatever living beings there may be, omitting nuns, let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state, let none to anger or ill will which harm upon another. So that's what. So on one retreat, when somebody pointed that out, I thought, good on you, that's a good line, a good joke. The next time we did the Metta chant, we changed it, to be fair. Whatever living beings there may be, omitting monks, let monks deceive another, or despise. It's a bit of fun and games. But it won't prevent you from going to a deeper level of meditation. You can actually use the joy and happiness of that and some of the Dhamma in it to actually to be able to get into the deep meditation. Hello, Ajahn. Hello, whoever this is. Could you please give us some more examples of being kind to your mind with different negative thoughts that may arise? Okay, I did also already mention about being kind to my stupid, sexy thoughts when I was going crazy. Just let them be. Okay, you can be. And then they vanish. Remember that I told someone the story of, Bodhinyana, being kind to my, food poisoning? And just allowing it just to go away so quickly, only 20 minutes. Full-on food poisoning, I think I mentioned that the first day. Full-on food poisoning vanished, because I was kind to it, not afraid. I mentioned about the Buddha being kind to Nalagiri. And if you're crazy, if you're really kind, okay, mind, you can do whatever you want. I'll always be your friend. Then that works. And I also mentioned to someone earlier, one of the most powerful acts of kindness is there's a lot of people who've had some very bad experiences in their life. You know, really bad experiences. And there's a group here in Perth called the Association of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. They call it ASSETS. I don't know where the E comes from, but anyway. It's a group of psychologists, doctors here in Perth, who deal with some of the refugees who come into Australia who've really, really been through hell. You know, in the underground prisons, tortured, multiple rapes. And they somehow survive. And they make it to Australia, but their mind is still in the torture camps. Their body is free, but not their mind. And these group of incredible people have to actually free their mind now, free their emotions, so they can enjoy the freedom of a place like Australia. And of course you can understand some of those stories they tell. It just makes your skin creep. What one human being can do to another, there's many things I can't comprehend, and that's one of them. How one person can do such cruelty, a real big time cruelty to another person. It's just, I don't understand it, honestly. But here you are. They've got these multiple rapes, torture, but they survive somehow physically. And I went to see the group. They're over in Stirling Street or something, or Beaufort Street. One of those. I always get those two streets mixed up in North Perth, or just north of Perth. It's not North Perth. It's one of the other suburbs, whatever it is. And anyway, I went there because they mostly all come, all psychiatrists come to Nolamara. Because they get all the things which work for me. And they said the one thing which worked the best for them was that old simile of opening the door of your heart. How it works. And it's very moving, just how they've used that, interpreted that. And I've taught it myself now. They tell these survivors, you know, when they're ready, they've got to feel safe, first of all. Now, to get the trust of the place and the people around them. It's a dangerous thing they're going to do. They sit down, close their eyes, they imagine a heart in their chest. Now, it's the Valentine's Day heart, you know, with the pointy at the bottom. And they imagine that, visualize that as best they can. And they imagine two big doors opening up in the middle of the hut. And a ladder, or one of those staircases which comes down, going down to the ground. And the person they like, the one part of them which they accept, is on top. And that little man who was tortured so badly, beaten, electrocuted, is down the bottom there. The girl who was raped, beaten, abused hundreds of times is down there. All those hundreds of little girls, those hundreds of men, every time they were beaten, it's down there. And you're standing on top because you have pushed them out, rejected them. You're afraid of them. It's the scariest thing. And then you invite them up, one at a time. Come up. This memory, which was so painful, which you've pushed out of your mind. You've got to invite it up. And you imagine it, just so much fear walking up those stairs, trembling. And you at the top, welcome them. Thank you so much for visiting. Thank you for coming up. Come inside. And one by one, every one of those memories looked upon as you, this body, this person who experienced it, is all welcomed up until the last one has come in. And then you're free. You haven't rejected, pushed it out. That's who you are. You cannot reject your history. You cannot somehow forget it. You embrace it. Invite it in. It's part of you. There's nothing wrong. And then you're free. That's how it works. And it's been very, very successful. That's actually how you're kind to all these little yous which have been so badly hurt. Now that is extreme, you know, what happens in that center. But each one of you have got parts of you which, you know, you've kept outside. Little yous which have done bad things or which have experienced bad stuff. Not as bad as those torture victims and multiple rapes. But still they're there. And one day you do that, you invite it in. Open the heart and imagine this little staircase and all these little Ajahn Brahms at the bottom there. The ones which, you know, I've rejected, even sort of suppressed, try to get out of my head. Come on, come up, guys. And we unite again. We're all inside. And then it's incredible, powerful catharsis. You're free now. So that's powerful stuff. And I'm very happy to know that actually works. You save people's lives. I read one of Ajahn Chah's books. Someone asked him if it is necessary to be able to enter absorption in our practice. He said, no, absorption is not necessary. You must establish a modicum of tranquility and one-pointedness of mind. Then you use this to examine yourself and nothing special is needed. That was badly translated, one of the first attempts by Jack Kornfield. The Buddha Ajahn Chah never said that. But he asked questions, he got the answers he wanted, and he translated those. So I was with Ajahn Chah for 9 years. Jack Kornfield was only there for 3 months. So he wasn't exactly a disciple, but he's used that for his career. So when I read that, I thought, oh, come on, that's not how Ajahn Chah taught. So that particular book is not accurate. So I'll leave it at that. That's not Ajahn Chah. Unfortunately, you get a famous teacher, and look, you know, I'm getting well known now. I say so much, so many talks. I'm sure you can go through all the talks, and you can find something which Ajahn Brahm says, no, you don't need to do jhanas. Ajahn Brahm said this. Because it's just like you are asking the question and you are, what I was saying yesterday, you are bending what you hear to suit what you want to hear. It's not what was actually said. It's actually what you wanted to hear. So when it comes from the mouth of Ajahn Chah, by the time it gets into your brain, it's not what he said.
Has that ever happened to you? So I didn't say that. I said, yes, you did. No, I didn't.
People have misheard, misinterpreted. So if you were living with that Gentile, it was jhanas. I once had a session of past life regression out of sheer curiosity. I am still unsure whether I actually travelled to a previous life or what I saw was created by my imagination. However, it was interesting that what felt like a short while was actually 4 hours in real time, and I now feel like it was a very deep meditation. Could you please explain a little bit about this phenomena? Yeah, I mean, two memories. It's a memory which is stored in your brain and a memory which is stored in this mind. And the brain is temporary, only lasts a lifetime. And your mind goes from life to life. So the memory stored in the mind, yes, you can have a huge amount of information there. And a good example of that was, there was a BBC documentary once. There was this poor fellow lived in London, and nobody knew why, but suddenly his memory was wiped out on one occasion. And when he sort of came to, he couldn't remember sort of who he was, nor the fact that he'd just got married to a new wife about 3 or 4 months ago. But he could still remember language, he can still do, you know, sums, but he didn't know who he was or where he was. And no one could understand why. And so this BBC documentary hired a hypnotist. They could hypnotize this guy, and they took him back. And they found out exactly what had happened. He was in the shed in the back of his house, you know, doing some woodwork, and the phone in the house rang. This was before mobile phones. And in order to answer the phone, he ran out of the shed. One of the window shutters was open. He hit his head on the window shutter. And that's what it was. You know, sometimes that happens. You can hit your head and it just knocks out the memory. And so in the documentary, they gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion. When he wakes up, he'll remember it. So he woke up and he couldn't remember a thing. So the memory he had in his brain was erased. But the memory he had in his mind, which is what you access through hypnosis and also through meditation, had perfect memory, knew everything what had happened. So this is one of the problems here. The memory stored in the brain, sometimes you can lose that. But the memory in the mind is really accurate. So to access that, you can use hypnosis or you can use meditation. And how you do that, you bypass the brain. And to do that, it takes a lot of letting go, which is why meditation works. But even in hypnosis, you have to get into a very tranquil, peaceful, trusting state to be able to access that. And you can access what happened before you were born. And you get past lives. But the point is, if you do get a good hypnotherapist, regressionist, will always ask you the questions. You know, to prompt you. Because you have, apparently, that as it's been described by me, and it's an interesting, I really agree with this, it's the emotions which come up first of all. You have the emotions of fear or love or peace. And then from that emotion, that opens the door to these past experiences. So, you know, you feel afraid. Why? What's going on? So a hypnotherapist has to ask questions. They cannot be leading questions. You're not saying, oh, you're an Indian, are you? Or, you know, you're with Jesus Christ, are you? Because those leading questions, you know, just really skew the whole thing. You say, you know, where are you? What are you wearing? You know, what can you see around you? And that, the regressionist, allows you to build up the picture. And then, what's your name? And then you can answer it. And then if you're lucky, because if it is that your past life, you know, for the last 200 years in most countries, we've kept records. So you can actually find out if it's true. And many people have found out it's true. There's one of the members of our Buddhist society. I can't tell you who he is, but some of you will certainly know him. And he did regression with Dennis Shepherd, and he remembered his previous life. He was on Fremantle, you know, the port city, and he watched redcoats come off the ship. And straight away he thought, there's something wrong there, because the British never wore the red coats at that time. But later on, of course, he went into the BT Library. Yes, they did. And he was wearing this brown uniform.
He didn't know what the heck that was, but he did research, and there was, and he also saw this in his past life memories. The British government had a specific type of soldier who was to look after the convicts, and they wear the brown uniform. And the deal was you do 3 or 4 years of service, you know, looking after the convicts, and then you were given a grant of land in Western Australia. And he remembered all of that. He remembered the part of the parcel of land he got, which was down south somewhere, north of Albany, around Mount Barker, or somewhere around that area. He remembered his name, and of course he went to the library and got the title deeds from that date. The land which he remembered, with his name on it. It's that so much really strong information. Names, places, times, dates, he got it all. And that really convinced him. And one of the results of him being convinced, no, he didn't. Yeah, he came along to the Buddhist Society, but he was not really committed at the time. You know, he just liked having a glass of beer with his friends. But as soon as he remembered his past life and looked at it, and it was real, it shocked him. Those memories they got in Dennis's house were true. You know, details, names, dates, places. And as a result of that, he said, oh God, I'd better keep these 5 precepts now. So he gave up his alcohol. He had to, could not do it. So it's a nice little story there. So yeah, you can do this. You can find out your past life through regression, but not everyone can do that. He said he was really stressed out at work, and he just was just so tired when he went to see Dennis. He said that may have been one of the reasons. All his defences were down. Anyway, Ajahn Chah has done very good deeds always. He has produced many monks like you. Yes, thank you. And done a very good service to people. Why has he become invalid in his last few years of life? Do you think he was in pain? Why had he to be like that? It's obviously some past karma from the previous life. Much like Mahamoggallana, he was beaten up. You know, he was a great monk. But he was beaten up by bandits because of some past karma he did in the previous life. So even though you're enlightened, you've still got the really serious karma which comes and hits you at the end. But, you know, physically you feel the pain, but emotionally you're free. Can you read other people's minds? I know who wrote that. No, I don't. As I said yesterday, if I could, I wouldn't tell you. And also, I would not read your mind. It's not worth reading. Really, I mean, have a look at your mind. And honestly, who would want to read that? It's bad enough you reading it. Did you ever get malaria as a monk in Thailand? Actually, I never did get malaria. Health-wise, I've always had some incredibly good karma. You know, other monks would get diarrhea. And we'd meet in the morning, and oh, I was up all night on the toilet. Yeah, me too. The other monk said, yeah, me as well. Everyone had diarrhea. And I said, I didn't. They didn't like me when I said things like that. But I had a very, very good good health. Still do. So I never got malaria. I got scrub typhus. That's about it. And also, I got my paycheck this evening. Woo! Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Someone got a paycheck. Woo-hoo-hoo. How you know the difference to let go of a thought or feeling to be with it? Okay, you let go of controlling it. You let go of doing. You let go of planning. The let go is how you react. And which means you let it be. So you let the thing be, which has already arrived, and you've let go of your reaction to it. That's the difference between letting go and letting be. Already feel myself lightened. I mean light-hearted, not enlightened. Okay. Hope one day the two letters E and N will be added in front to liberate from this roaming in samsara. But, you know, the word enlightenment, it's a great word. You know, you mean you're very light, free. You haven't got these heavy thoughts. You know, you haven't got this depression, like having all this weight on you. Having to achieve. Sometimes, how many more days for this retreat? A couple of days left. And you think, oh God, only a couple of days. Please don't make it heavy. Just enjoy the last couple of days. Don't think, oh, I've got to get enlightened. Well, I've got to get something. I'm going to go home soon, and my husband, my wife is going to say, how did you get, darling? Did you get the first jhana this time? I said, no. Did you get nimittas? Did you get nimittas? No. Did you get the beautiful breath? No. And you feel so upset. So, so don't go having goals. When you go home, you say, I got the attainment of not being concerned with getting goals. That's a nice thing to say. That really impresses, confuses people. The attainment of going beyond all goals. Sounds really good, doesn't it? That will satisfy them. It also means you can relax and enjoy yourself. I go to work 6 days. 6 days? I go to work 7 days a week. 2 weekends and a public holiday. We had Australia Day last Tuesday. I worked through all of them. Did I get penalty rates, double time? Nothing. This Buddhist society. No. If I was a Mark Twain said, when you like your vocation becomes your vacation. You enjoy doing it, so it's not work anymore, it's fun. I go to work for 6 days while I'm at home. I do housework, listen to Dhamma. Am I doing wrong? Please advise me. Thanks. Yeah, get a smaller house. My housework in my cave, actually I don't even do it, other people do that. But if I did it myself, it would take maybe half an hour, a week. It's only a cave, it's a small thing. So, you know, you just have a small house. Then you get your housework done in half an hour on a weekend. Not only that, but you don't have to work for six. Why do you have to work for 6 days? To pay the bills. Why do you have so many bills? Because you have such a big house. A lot of electricity, a lot of gas, a lot of everything else. Cleaning and stuff. Smaller house. How much do you really need? And sometimes we can go against the flow and have small houses. Find it's so easy to live then. They're not worth very much because they're small, and which means you're free and have no more debts, and it means that you can have a very nice life. Not need to pay off so much money, and you won't have to work 6 days, do 3 days. Housework, half an hour done. Husband wants something for dinner, get takeaway. Who am I? I know who you are. I recognize the handwriting. Ask the audience to guess. I am all... Oh, okay. This is a joke sort of quiz. Who am I? Ask the audience to guess. I am always here. You can feel me physically and emotionally. You can know me. I rise and fall. You can make me soft or heavy and move me with your will. I can grasp and release. Some may think I'm a giant. But you may think I am small. Most of the time you don't think of me at all. Who am I? Teddy bear. No? Who am I? And the answer is, da da da. That's very, very profound. I'll say it again. Who am I? I am always here. You can feel me physically and emotionally. You can know me. I rise and fall. You can make me soft or heavy and move me with your will. I can grasp and release. Some may think I'm a giant, but you may think I am small. Most of the time you don't think of me at all. Who am I? No? That's what's not written on the back here. I'll tell you at the end. That's actually very good, whoever wrote that. Dear Ajahn, what are the criteria selection to ordain as a bhikkhuni here? Another one. See, they all come together the same day. Is there an age limit or health? Yeah, as long as you're breathing. Is there any trial period? Yes, we get a judge to give a trial. May I have the wisdom and strength to detach from the cow shit? Exactly. Little worm, come and become a bhikkhuni. Yeah, I've already answered that. And if you want any more advice, go and talk to the bhikkhunis. What is a bodhisattva? Is this referring to a person who wishes to be reborn as a human to help human beings? Does that mean a bodhisattva is not a sotapanna? I understand that once a person reaches sotapanna, he or she can no longer wish to be reborn as a human or not. Exactly. So, the original meaning of the word bodhisattva was only used to describe the person who was to become a Buddha once he left the Tushita realm, which is previous heavenly birth, before he came down to Lumbini. And so from the time that he descended from the Tushita realm until the time of his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, that period of the person's life, he was called bodhisattva. Anything before that was never called bodhisattva. This was only that time in its last birth before the enlightenment. From birth to under the Bodhi tree was called bodhisattva. So all it meant was just a person who was last birth about to become the Buddha. Very close. Of course, that was extended later on by other monks, nuns, other traditions to go way back. And that's where we get all those Jataka tales. Somebody asked a question of the Vaisantara giving away his wife and kids, which was totally irresponsible. When I first read that, that's not moral. That is actually quite sick to do something like that. But people actually celebrate that as a previous life of the Buddha. That's no wisdom, no compassion at all to do things like that. And as a Westerner, I asked that question. Other people, I just believe, oh, it's the monk said it's the life of a Buddha, so it must be good. Not at all. So that is the original meaning of bodhisattva. It is just the time of a Buddha from his birth or her birth. Can a woman become a Buddha? From the birth until the enlightenment. That's called a bodhisattva. However, many other people use it as more metaphorically, that when you have a very, very kind heart giving to other people, it's like a bodhisattva. So that's quite nice. Have a bodhisattva heart, which means you don't just think of yourself, you help other people. And that is important for letting go. In all, the Eightfold Path includes kindness, compassion, giving to others. The Eightfold Path leads to Nirvana. It's not just about you, it's about others as well. So, but once you're a Sotapanna, you can't be decide to give up your rebirth to help other people. Again, it's not your will anymore. You can't do that anymore. It just happens. How to speak mindfully? Is it possible to watch the breath while talking? Now, the only way to speak mindfully is just to pause before you say things. Just like when I was giving on the radio in Singapore, they always said there's a delay on the radio in Singapore of about 20, 30 seconds. There's always someone monitoring you, and if you say the wrong word, like shit, in Singapore, it stops, so they never hear it. So there's that 20-second delay to allow things to be edited. So that's what you can do. You have this, not 20 seconds or 10 seconds, have this 5-second delay before you speak, just to make sure you're mindful of what you're going to say. Is that really worthwhile? That's how you can be more mindful when you speak. So just have a little delay. Just, what am I going to say? Obviously, you can't think like that. That takes too long. But you just, what am I saying? Is that right or wrong? Was Moggallana used to be Mara? Yes, he did. Mara is the control freaking chief. And Mara always comes along to try and stop people becoming enlightened. So, if you've had any problems during this retreat, your meditation's no good, it's not your fault. It's Mara. So you don't have to feel ashamed. After all, think, who are you to defeat Mara? It was a really close call under the Bodhi tree between Mara and the Buddha, but the Buddha won. But that was the Buddha. And who do you think you are to defeat Mara? You arrogant. So anyway, that's Mara. But Mara is control freak. Mara is a personification of will. Now you know who Mara is. Will, controlling, doing stuff. That causes suffering. And it keeps you in samsara. You want to do jhanas, you want to make enlightenment happen. And you never do. That's why letting go really pisses off Mara. You always do something to try and make you do something. Anyway, next question. Somewhere here is the question. Oops, here he is. Dear Ajahn, do you have any opinions why hypnotism seems to work on some people and not on others? Have often wondered why. I think it's just the amount of ability to let go, or how much you control. And of course, the ability to let go, you have to feel safe, be encouraged to let go. There are a lot of illusionist magicians. Are those skills attained through meditation? Is it just using the power of concentration, or are they using dark skill? If they use concentration power, does that mean they reach jhana too? Devadatta also used skill in magic. If he meditates and have reached jhana, why has he still bad intentions? The first part of the question, magicians on TV, have they got powers? And I remember one of the monks once said, it was, I think, David Copperfield. You know, somebody showed a few clips and he could fly through the air. He could do this amazing stuff. And somebody mentioned that he must have psychic powers. And so he must have jhanas to get those. And then somebody else said, no, he can't have, because he was going out with the German supermodel. What was her name? Claudia Schiffer. He said, if you're going out with Claudia Schiffer, you'll never get jhanas. No, this is just, you can do with a few million dollars, you know, in your budget for these shows, because these shows go all over the world. They make a lot of money. They cost a lot of money. Special effects. You do almost anything with special effects, and people believe it. There was, I shouldn't really tell you who this group were, but they did this in Thailand. They told all their disciples there's going to be a magic event, a supernatural psychic power from their teacher at a huge place over in outside of Bangkok. It was a really dodgy organization. And they told there's going to be a psychic power demonstrated by their teacher. And sure enough, thousands of people came. And they all saw it was real. They saw a picture, image of the Buddha appear on the clouds. And they all sadhu, and they gave so many donations. It was just laser. You know, that they do in rock concerts. You can create an image on a cloud of David Bowie or the Beatles, whatever you like, because this is just a technique invented in the West. But they were sharp enough to know they'd seen this invention before. Someone saw it in one of the rock concerts. And they thought, people in Thailand, they won't know this. And they said it was a psychic power. It was just an ordinary just event. And they sort of cheated people by saying it was a psychic power. And they all thought it was magic. Why do they think it's magic? Because they wanted to see that their leader do a magic trick. And they wanted that so much, they even denied afterwards it was done by a laser when it was found out it was done by a laser. That's the trouble with psychic powers. That if you really have them, you don't show them. If you show them, it means you're faking them. So that's usually what happens. And then the TV, for goodness sake. You can do anything on the TV. Someone actually showed me. There was this English magician called Dynamo. And he walked across the Thames. And that was an amazing. He actually walked on water. So he got on the Thames River, just outside of the House of Parliament, but on the other side of the river, and he started walking on water. And all the people on the Westminster Bridge, they were looking in, videoing him. Wow, somebody actually walking on water like Jesus did. And he walked so far, and he stopped, and then a police launch came and arrested him for walking across the water. That was actually the end of the clip. And the reason they had to have a police launch there because someone got on the internet and explained exactly how it was done. It was done by another magician in England earlier on. Plastic glass? What was it called? Perspex, yeah. Perspex, an inch under, 2 inches under the water, you just can't see it. It was walking on that. And they couldn't take it all the way across the Thames because his boat's going off. It would have cracked it. So he got so far, and then they arranged for this fake police boat to go and arrest him so he didn't have to walk any further. That's as far as he could go. It's just walking on perspex. It's just, that's a simple trick. And in magic, once you see how it's done, you think, oh God, how could I be so stupid to believe that was a psychic power? It's just a trick, that's all. But there's not anything psychic. And what you say, Devadatta, if you do start showing off psychic powers, you lose them. You get proud. And that was Devadatta. Yes, he did get jhanas. Yes, he did get psychic powers. But then he decided that he was going to own them, that they were his attainments. And he was such a great monk, and that's why he wanted to lead the Sangha. And as soon as he had that ego, he could not do them anymore. You lose them because of pride. What is intuition? How come it seems to know best? I'm just going here from a science explanation about it. It's what you feel, what's right and what's wrong. And that more or less goes to your subconscious. You've had so much experience, you've amassed such a lot of information, but the thinking can't access it, intuition can. It's like this huge database of experience. And intuition accesses that database rather than thoughts. You know, just can access maybe what you've been taught, what you've read recently. So it's a huge amount of information which intuition is based on, and it's liable to be far more accurate. Not always right, but far more accurate. So all these tests they've given in psychology, you know, think about the answer and then do it, or just feel the answer, use your intuition and do it. And it's always more accurate to have intuition than to think it through. Dear Bhante, can someone be sotapanna by only doing walking meditation? If can, please, can you explain how to do it? Is this the only way you look, feel at your foot when you walk, as you explained earlier? Many thanks. The only way to become a stream winner, again, eightfold path. It's not just walking meditation. You have to get some right view. Yes, the way you do the walking meditation, it's keeping your precepts, you know, the right speech, action, livelihood, the effort to let go, mindfulness, and eventually jhanas. Remember, eightfold path. People always want the easy way, but it's always back to eightfold path. The Buddha was very kind. If anything in that eightfold path wasn't necessary, he would have made it the sevenfold path for you. Or the sixfold path. But you need all eight. Samsara is without a discoverable beginning. But do chittas have a beginning point in time? If so, does each chitta have its own individual genesis point, such that one being or stream of consciousness could be older or younger than another? That is a nice question. It doesn't really, you know, have any bearing on your meditation, but there is a couple of places where the Buddha says, like, even plants have a rudimentary form of consciousness. So, when you eat a carrot, you are destroying a potential stream of consciousness. You murderers. But, don't feel bad about that. But they say that from plant life can evolve. That stream of consciousness, there is something there, can go into another plant life. Because anyone who's done any sort of botany and whatever it's called, you know, there are some plants which you can't really say whether they're in animals or whether they're in plants. The things like Venus flycatchers and stuff. They exhibit some of the qualities of a being, a sentient being. But there are many qualities of what we consider to be plant-like. So you can see, just there's a whole gradation. It's not just plants and animals, human beings. It's like a gradation of sort of ability to be conscious, to use intelligence, to communicate. And it seems that the Buddha was saying that you can go up that gradation. Go down again as well. You can evolve and devolve. The streams of consciousness which evolve to the animal world, the higher animals, human beings, devas. You know, they have been sort of plants before. So that's what the Buddha was saying. That's what the Tibetan Buddha is saying, but it's actually in the suttas as well. It's an interesting idea, yeah. Mind, stream of consciousness, does actually evolve. The Darwinian theory of evolution is not just bodies, but streams of consciousness. Who are the other monks or lay people that you know who have heard who are great meditation teachers like yourself? Who can I recommend? You don't recommend anybody. You don't have the authority to give a stamp of approval.
Venerable Jaga, approved by Ajahn Brahman, stamped on his forehead. So, because, you know, as a monk, I've only had one real teacher, which was Ajahn Chah. And so other monks, you know, you haven't really been under them, so you don't really know them that much. And so I don't go to see other teachers, and I'm senior enough. Whenever I go to see other monks, I'm always the one who has to give the talk, because I'm the eldest. But I don't know what these other monks are doing or up to, so I can't really answer that question. Instead, you go and find out. But be careful. Don't just think a monk is enlightened by what they say. Check them out, what they do. Because, again, I've known many people who can speak really, really high Dhamma, but they're not really practicing very well. But it has to be coming from the heart, from experience. Otherwise, it's not working. Dear Ajahn, when we watch the breath, it is like we are watching it from a distance and not too close. That is a very useful thing, to watch it at a distance, which means you don't get caught up in it. This is one of the other similes of the TV. I remember going in the airports, especially Singapore airports. I always go through there to go to other countries, and people are watching the TV. And I know this in Terminal 3, in the not to the centre, a little bit to, I think it was the E or the F. Anyway, there's a place there where they have this big TV, they're always watching soccer matches on it. And I see people looking at that soccer match on this huge TV in Singapore Airport, and they start shouting, "Shoot, shoot, shoot! Offside, ref, that's offside!" And I've seen them do that. And it reminded me when I was a kid, we used to go to the movies, and sometimes you'd have, I remember one movie, it was Tarantula. Now, there's really stupid movies in those days, okay, no special effects, bad storylines, but apparently a tarantula had been involved in a nuclear accident and it mutated this huge thing which was eating people. And so the tarantula would actually crawl behind people. And I did notice, I think it's, you can confirm whether it's still the same. If it's a monster, a tarantula or a vampire, they only attack the really young, beautiful woman. If you're old and fat, the tarantula leaves you alone. You're absolutely safe. So the moral of that story is, if you ever see a monster, a vampire, if you're old and fat, no need to worry. They just go for the beautiful young girls. Is it still the same? I know it used to be the same. Crazy stuff. But anyway, so the tarantula was crawling or just about to jump on this beautiful young heroine of the movie. Just creeping. You know, like it's like in movies, creeping very slowly, building up the suspense. And then someone in the audience would shout out, "Hey, look behind you, tarantula!" They would always do that. What a stupid thing to do. It's a movie. Okay? I mean, it's already been filmed. Whatever the tarantula's going to do, it's already programmed to do it. All your shouting is not going to work. And if it was a tarantula, tarantulas can't hear, they haven't got ears. Or if you're shouting at the soccer match, it's a replay. It's already happened. And anyway, you're watching something which is happening in Anfield in Liverpool, and you're in Singapore. Even if it was live, they can't hear you from Singapore. But people are, have you ever seen your husband do that on the TV? Yes, see. Why do they do that? It's interesting. Because when you're watching a TV or a movie, you get actually sucked inside. Your perception at the time is actually you are in the stadium. You're in Singapore, but you forget that. You're so caught up in the movie. You're actually on the set. You really believe that Tarantula or the lady can hear you. You get sucked into the action. And that's where you get emotionally involved. And having seen that, experienced that myself, and then see the simile with your thoughts. The only reason they keep going is you get sucked inside. This is real, your thoughts. You have a fantasy, you're experiencing it. It's real. But if you're watching a movie or watching a football match, and you stand back, put some space between you and the screen, you realize, I'm in Singapore. I can feel the seats. This is not Anfield. This is Singapore. You can feel the heat. This is certainly not Liverpool. It's freezing there. So, you realize this is not the movie. You're sitting at home. And when you put that distance between you and the movie, you don't get emotionally caught up. It's only a movie. You can enjoy it. But you don't go shouting at the movie characters. And if you can do that with your thoughts, the thoughts are out here. It's like a movie, but you're totally separate. You're independent. It's not affecting you. You don't get caught up in it, and it's so easy to let them go then. In fact, when you do separate yourself from the movie, it's such a stupid movie. We don't get caught up emotionally. Tarantula. There aren't such things as mutant tarantulas. If it's a movie, whether it's all these Batman, Supermans, Iron Man, Copper Man, or I don't know what else, Copper Woman, Rubber Man. Has it got Rubber Man? Rubber Man would be really good. Anyway, whatever it is. And you know what's going to happen. I can predict the storyline. Somebody does something stupid, the world is about to end, the Martians are about to invade, and the only thing which stands between the survival and of the world and doom for the whole of humanity is Rubber Man. And Rubber Man makes so many mistakes, and in the end it's just such touch and go. Whether the world's going to end or Rubber Man's going to save it. But heroically, and Rubber Man's always from the United States, by the way. That's true. And Rubber Man, finally, he kills a villain or something, or he vanishes into outer space, and the world is saved again. And you've just wasted 2 hours watching that crap. You didn't need to do that. You could have just known what's going to happen in the end. But we like to see it happen. So fair enough. At least you know what you're doing, wasting time. So thoughts are just like that. Someone once said, all their fantasies... And made this very good comment. In your fantasies, you're always the hero. You never lose in fantasies. You always get the guy. You always win. You always hit the winning runs for Sri Lanka in the World Cup. The winning goal for Liverpool in the cup final. In fantasies, you always win. That's why they're enjoyable, but they're totally ridiculous. In real life, you can't kick a ball for your life. You get bowled first ball. But anyway, it would be great if the people who use the soft toys keep them in front later so everyone would get an opportunity to have the experience. Thank you very much. Oh yes, share the teddy bears. It's very good. There's one spare over here. Someone used it and gave it up again so someone else can make use of it. So that's wonderful to share the teddy bears. Dear Ajahn, according to your viewpoint, how many hours of sleep does an average meditator require? How many hours a day do you sleep? I don't sleep hours. I just sleep a moment, just now. That's all you ever have. Don't count the minutes and hours. Don't be a prisoner of time. You go to bed, you fall asleep. When you wake up, you get up. Keep it natural. Sometimes you don't need very much. Sometimes you need a lot. Feel the body, how much it needs. Dear Ajahn, I have tried recollecting past lives empowered by jhana using your earliest memory method, but without success. I only get early childhood memories. Are there other methods I could try? Also, if my last life was in the animal or deva realm, does this affect recall? One thing you can do is you can die, and then once you die, then this is your last life. So that's an easy one to remember. So if that doesn't work, sometimes it does take a bit of courage to go, early childhood memories, earlier please, go into the womb. Can I feel what it's like in my mum's womb? Ask specific questions. And go earlier back until you can really go so early. And there's a danger here, which I always love telling people. I don't love it, but I have to. Sometimes when you do get your past life experience, the first experience of your past life is the time closest to this one, when you died. And that's unpleasant. So a couple of people have done that. Yes, they've got their past life experience, and they come out a bit in interviews. Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell people to do that again. That was a really awful experience. Because you're back there. You're feeling what it's like to die again. Death is okay, but just beforehand, it's usually very, very unpleasant. That's why many people just, ooh, I don't want to do this again. But if that ever happens to you, all you need to do, if it's an unpleasant experience of your previous life, quite often your death moment, just say earlier, please. Go back earlier. And usually if your mind has just emerged from a jhana or a deep meditation, it's easy to do. The mind will do anything. You just ask it to do it and it does it straight away. So if you have stronger meditation, it's easier to do. But if it was as an animal, it depends what type of animal, but if it was a worm in a pile of dung, then you'll notice in this life, dung is always very fragrant. You still have some memories and some of your inclinations from the past. You know, you like to play around in manure or whatever. You love doing compost. If you love doing compost, it must mean that in the previous life... I don't know, I was only making that one up. But anyway, keep on trying, because it's nice when you do get it. If it's a deva realm, that's even harder to really get, because that's very refined. And it's so different from this life, sometimes you can't recognize the signs. So those things are very, very hard. The closer it is to human life, the easier it is to understand. Last question, there's a few left here. Maybe I'll see if I can finish. Can you please explain the difference between jhanas versus vipassana and satipatthana? Which method is better over the others, or why one is prescribed over the others? There's no difference. If you read the Satipatthana Sutta, they say that, read the Anapanasati Sutta. Anapanasati leads to jhanas. The 12th stage of the Anapanasati is jhana. And the Buddha says anyone who fulfills Anapanasati also fulfills Satipatthana. Anyone who fulfills Satipatthana fulfills the seven enlightenment factors. In other words, you're enlightened. So, by doing Anapanasati, you're doing Satipatthana at the same time. You are doing enlightenment at the same time. So, is Anapanasati, is that Samatha or is that Vipassana? Which one is it? The Buddha said it's Satipatthana. It's right there, Anapanasati Sutta, have a look at it. So there's only one way, which is Eightfold Path. There's no difference there. You need insight to get jhana. From jhana you get insight, and both of them are Satipatthana. No difference at all. Nati jhananga panyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jhananga panya chasta vai nibbana santike. Verse 372 of Dhammapada. I hope I'm impressing you. Because I have to do this because sometimes people say Ajahn Brahm makes it up. Where in the suttas is this? And I learnt this one because what it means is there is no jhana without wisdom. Okay, let's call it insight. There's no jhana without insight. There's no insight without jhana. But when you have insight and jhana, you are in the presence of nibbana. Very beautiful. Why did not the Lord Buddha give permission to ordain nuns at first, and why he gave permission next? Again, that whole passage is very dubious. Reason why, there is another, even more well-known passage that just after the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree. Okay, this guy Mara, control freak, he tried to stop the Buddha getting enlightened, but he gave up. The Buddha beat him, so the Buddha became the Buddha, became fully enlightened. So the next thing Mara did, he said, well done, yes, you're enlightened, you're a Buddha, congratulations, mate. But no need to teach. Take it easy. Teaching is such a hassle. People ask you all these questions and they never follow instructions. It just gives you headaches all the time. So just take it easy. And the Buddha said no. He said, I will not take it easy. I will not pass away until I have created a strong sangha of bhikkhus, a strong sangha of bhikkhunis, lay followers of both genders, men and women, who are strong and firm in the Dhamma. Only after I have created those four groups will I pass away. And at the Chapala shrine, 3 months before the Buddha's Parinibbana, Mara came up to him and said, well, you remember that conversation we had? There is great sangha of monks, great sangha of nuns, great number of lay men and lay women who are sotapalas, anagamis. So, you've completed your task. And the Buddha said, yeah, actually, you're right, yes. So I'll pass away in 3 months. That was his mission. It was his stated goal to ordain nuns and monks and to teach lay men and lay women. That was his goal. That was the reason why he didn't pass away after getting enlightened. So that is very clear from the suttas. That was the Buddha's intention from the beginning. So why would he say, no, let's not ordain nuns, when he was promised to do that from the start? It's those sorts of quotes, which are very, very strong, which makes many monks, many scholars doubt that passage. And when I showed it to someone recently, that comes in the chapter, I think, 10 of the Churawaka, towards the very, very end. After that chapter, chapter 11 is about the first council, which obviously happened after the time of the Buddha, and chapter 12 is the second council, happened later on. This is at the end of the book, where if anything was added, you would add it. So many monks, scholars, think that that is out of character, that is inconsistent, contradictory to what it said elsewhere in many places, therefore it's probably added. So that's what I think as well. The idea of Lord Buddha not giving permission to ordain nuns doesn't make any sense. It's not consistent with what he promised to do at the very beginning and why he decided, mission accomplished, now I can parinibbana. The participants of this retreat have come from different parts of the world and belong to different cultures too. Isn't it nice if each one gives a brief introduction of themselves and reveal their impressions of what they experienced during the stay here? They can be done on the last day, suggestion only. There's so many people here. It will take forever. And the really interesting ones won't say anything. The arrogant, talkative ones will talk about themselves all afternoon. That's what I found in the past. So, just you can go out to people on the last day and you can talk to people. You can find out yourself. Okay. There's two questions there. So, it's 9:40. I've gone over time. So this is the last question for tonight. These two for tomorrow. Oh, and I've got to give you the answer afterwards to that riddle. How does one have faith in confidence in ancient religious texts when they were originally written so long ago and may have been altered for manipulation, greed or power over time since their inception? And the answer to that is in that book which I mentioned, written by Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Bamali, called The Authenticity Project. How can we know that those texts which we have now are authentic to the time of the Buddha? And there's some really powerful arguments they've amassed over the years. One of them, which was my contribution, was the fact, how can you change those texts? What's the mechanism? If you have a teaching of the Buddha, how can it be manipulated? To manipulate texts, you need a power. A pope can manipulate texts. But the way that Buddhism works is with this incredible, unwieldy democracy. In other words, you have to get every monk agreeing. And so if I wanted to change the text, all the other monks would say, no, that's not what's right. I don't have the authority to do that. No one has the authority to do that. Except the whole community, the Sangha. And not just one Sangha, all the monks have to come together to alter the text. So how can it be altered? Yeah, there may be a group of monks in one monastery that don't like this, and so they write in something. But all the other monks have to come on board as well. So it's very, very difficult to do. And it can be done, but it's very, very difficult. And the only way it can be done is on the edges of the texts, the last parts of it. I mean, places which aren't really important. It's not core teaching, so people don't really worry about it. But the core teaching is very hard to change. And that's one of the reasons. And one of the other reasons is that we can actually go back, because those teachings were taken over to places like China, and there's many, many different recensions of them. And where they they match, at least we know it hasn't been changed for those 1,500 years, 2,000 years when those first texts went to China. Because they branched, they lost contact with each other. They'd have to change the Indian version, the Sri Lankan version, as well as the Chinese version, which is very, very unlikely. So if the Indian version, the Sri Lankan version, the Chinese version, they match, you should really know that that comes from that time when those texts were separated. And we've also got the language used. Because again, the science of dating texts, which was done for the Christian Bible and by the Western scholarship, you can usually tell the sort of language which is used, such as, if you tell your friends you had a gay weekend at Jhana Grove, they know exactly what you mean. But if you said 50 years ago, that just meant you were happy, had a joyful time. Words change their meaning. And you can tell from the context that if someone mentions a gay weekend and they were having sort of nice time with the people of the same gender, you know that must have been written, maybe in the last 20 years. You know, if they say they had a gay weekend and it was just like a lot of jollity, good time, happiness, but no sort of homosexual sex, you know that must have been written about 50 years ago or 60 years ago. So for those words, you can actually date these texts. And that's why you use those sorts of arguments to find out whether those texts were written early or late. So you can actually date parts of the Tripitaka. And that's where you realize that the Abhidhamma is late. There's another few other books which are late. Mostly in the Kudaka Nikaya, which was miscellaneous. They could add things in there. Some are early, but most of it is late. So that's actually how you find out. You use reason, logic. And you find out the mass of those teachings is really consistent, makes a lot of sense. Those things you know must have been original. Okay, so the last riddle. Who am I? I am always here. You can feel me physically and emotionally. You can know me. I rise and fall. You can make me soft or heavy and move me with your will. I can grasp and release. Some may think I'm a giant, but you may think I'm small. Most of the time you don't think of me at all. Who am I? And the very deep answer. The big toe. That's why it's so stupid. I like it. Who am I? I am always here, yeah. You can feel me physically and emotionally. I can feel my big toe emotionally. You can know me. I rise and fall. Yeah, you rise and fall. You can make me soft or heavy. I'm not quite sure what soft or heavy is. And move me with your will. I can grasp and release. You can hold things with your big toe. Some may think I'm giant, but you may think I'm small. Most of the time you don't think of me at all. Makes sense? Big toe. Are you disappointed? That's the trouble with riddles. Okay, so here we go. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So have a nice night. Sorry for going on an extra 15 minutes. We've only got one more question time tomorrow night, so I wanted to actually make some headway. There's just two questions which weren't answered, so they'll be tomorrow.